reviewing, but I do want to go to this slide that we've seen over and over again and ask you in chapters 1 and 2, the bigger picture is that Jesus is greater than who? The angels. And in verse 1, He's greater than who? 1:1. Chapter 1 and verse 1. The prophets, yes. He's greater than the prophets. We also see in chapters 1 and 2, clearly in chapter 1, Jesus is shown as being who? The Son. Not quite yet, Chester. But in chapter 1, it is the Son. Preeminent Son. In chapter 2, we see Him clearly as a what? A man. Okay? And so, we have this idea that He is the Son of God. He is God Himself, but He's also man, which uniquely qualifies Him. If you look in chapter 2 and verse 17, we have this first hint. Qualifies Him to be what? The high priest. We get into chapter 3 and 4. In chapter 3, we see that Jesus is greater than the lawgiver, the intercessor, Moses. He's greater than him. Moses was a servant in God's house. Jesus was a son, where? Over the house. Yes, and then he goes into the warning, which is actually the second warning in 3:7 through 4:13, and he uses who as the example of who we should not be like. Who should we not be like? From 3:7 to 4:13. Exodus generation, who rebelled. And the psalm that's quoted over and over in that is which psalm? One that says, today, if you hear His voice. Which psalm is that? 95. Psalm 95. Okay, and then we get into chapters 5, which is the talk about, actually 4:14 through 10:18 is about the high priest. And we saw in chapter 7 that he's a priest after the order of, which comes from which psalm and which verse? 110:4, yes, close. Psalm 110:4. And then we saw on Wednesday night, this right here. Now, this is the main point of the things that we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens. A minister. Jesus is a minister. He's now the one who performs priestly service in the sanctuary. He is the minister now. In the sanctuary, in the true tabernacle, which the Lord, not man, set up. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that the priest also have something to offer. And so we're going to see what this priest has to offer in chapters 9 and 10. Jesus is the high priest, so we have a new high priest, new covenant. We need a new sanctuary. We're going to read about that in chapter 9. We're also going to learn about what Jesus in this new role and where he's actually working and ministering, what he actually does for us. And so we'll see that in chapters 9 and 10. Big picture of chapter 9. He's going to show us in verses 1 through 10 the earthly tabernacle. And the point of this, it is symbolic. The whole system was a symbol. And one of the things that it signified is that the old law could not really fix the problem of man's sins. And therefore, we as worshipers could never come close to God. That's what it said. That's what when you look at how it's laid out and how it was used, that's what we see, that we cannot get to God up under the old law, and it's never going to fix the problem of sin. All right? So that's what we're going to see in verses 1 through 10. Big picture, though, is Christ, our high priest, has gone into the true tabernacle, which is where? In heaven. With His own blood, as opposed to the blood of what? Bulls and goats. He introduced what? The new covenant. And as a result of this, it cleanses our sins and it cleanses our conscience of sins, which the old law never could. And we'll get to that in verse 9 and 10. So those are kind of big pictures. So first we're going to look at the actual tabernacle, and he's going to show once again that this was just a shadow, a model, or a copy of what was to come. And thus to show, if it was just a model of what was to come, it's really not what God meant to have long term. It doesn't bring us into God's presence. It is inadequate. And it's to remind the readers that if this particular tabernacle was not really what God meant to have long term, it means that the old law is really just a shadow. It was meant to be done away with. And how could these followers of Christ who were Jews want to now go back to the old law? God never meant it to be in place. It was obsolete. Chapter 8, I think, said it was disappearing. All right, and we'll talk about that as well. So the actual tabernacle, when did it, why was it there? After Exodus 24, when the old law is actually ratified, God says, construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. And then verse 29, chapter 29 of the book of Exodus, verses 44 through 46. So I will consecrate the tabernacle of meeting that I may dwell among them. All right. So here we have verses 1 through 5. Now even the first covenant, which one was that? The first as opposed to the second? Law of Moses, yes, had regulations of divine worship. So there are some things that God said we want you to do in this particular sanctuary, but it dealt with the sanctuary that was on earth. All right, for there was a tabernacle. What does that mean, that word mean in the Greek, if you were to look it up? Tabernacle is a tent. Yes, very good. It's a tent, which implies what about this? Temporary, yes. It was prepared. The outer one, in which there were a lampstand and the table and the sacred bread, this is called the holy place. Behind the second, which is interesting, because most of the time we just think of it as a tent, right? This is talking about the outer one and the inner one, two of them. Why do you think he would perhaps phrase it in those terms, the first one and the second one? You did. And ultimately, could everybody get to that second one? No. I think perhaps he's trying to say, you know what, this second one is separate from the first. And we're going to talk about that. So he's saying that there's something unique about this most holy place. So we've seen this before many times. This is the structure and dimensions of the tabernacle. And you see that you would enter from the east side. There's one gate that you could go through on the east side, and you go in, and there's the bronze altar. You got the bronze laver. It's interesting, when you go from the outer court, as you go deeper in, it's kind of like Fort Knox. Metals become what? More precious. But yet, restriction becomes what? Greater, yes. All right, so I believe I got another picture here. So here you have, they would set up tent, they would have the Levites and the priests would be right around the actual tabernacle, and then you'd have three of the tribes per side, and that's how they would set up camp. And inside of the actual tabernacle, you had these different items, a golden lampstand, the altar of incense, the table of showbread, were all in the holy place. And then you had the veil, and then you had the Ark of the Covenant in the holy place, the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. Now you had these different items. First of all, you had the lampstand, sometimes called a candlestick. Yes, Michael? Right, yeah. Right. That's great. And what you just basically said was is that this set up is a symbol. And he was giving all the different symbols, and I won't even try to repeat that, but you know, it's how we are cleansed, and we can actually go into the most holy place. It's a symbol, and even these particular items perhaps had symbolic meaning. And some of them we don't know for sure, and I threw down some thoughts here as to perhaps what they meant. We don't know for sure, but just some thoughts. Since this whole system is symbolic, you know, what did these things mean? Well, the lampstand had seven different branches, and on each end you had oil that would burn. It's not like a candle today with a wick. It was oil in the end, and it would burn. And the lamps were extinguished each morning and lit each night and burned all night whenever the extra tabernacle was assembled. The lighted lamp was in the form of a tree whose branches ended in a lamp or a light. And it symbolized perhaps the Spirit of God, or perhaps that God provides light and illumination and knowledge. Just some thoughts there about what perhaps that means. And then you go to the next one, which is the table of showbread. Stood on the opposite end of the lampstand, on the north side of the room. On this table they had a blue cloth, and it was placed 12 loaves of bread and two rows of six loaves each. It symbolized perhaps God's provision of food and His care for His people. Then you had the next item is the golden altar. It was small. It was made of wood, overlaid with gold. Incense was burned there twice a day, and the smoke from the incense symbolized, as Michael said, the prayers of God's people going up to God. And there are several different verses where it says what that was a symbol of. Get to the next one, and it's the veil which separated the two rooms. This is called the second veil because there was a veil up front that would separate the courtyard from the holy place. And then we get to the other one. It's talking about the Ark of the Covenant. But before we get there, to those who read really close, you'll see perhaps there's a problem, because when we get into the Holy of Holies, it says that in the Holy of Holies there's the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant. Well, what do we just say about the golden altar? Where was it in the diagram that I just put up? Outside, in the holy place. But this is saying it's inside of the Holy of Holies. Contradiction? Did the author really not know this? Well, I think that's obviously not the case. So why would he perhaps put this in the Holy of Holies? Any thoughts on that? That's great. So the smoke from the prayers was symbolic, and it would waft into the Holy of Holies. In particular, this altar was tied in on one particular day. Perhaps its most vital role was on the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16. And so the smoke that you had there, it would have to fill up the Holy of Holies. It would have to go behind the veil before the priest went in, before the high priest went in. And when that occurred, he was able to go in because it says that God's that His presence would be in the smoke. And that's what all these points say here. Cherry just summarized most of it. It's clear that one of the most significant uses of the altar was in relation to the Ark of the Covenant, and the accounts for its location and description in connection with the most holy place. This item in the tabernacle is being described more in terms of its function than its actual location. So its function was to fill the room of the most holy place. And so really it's being described in terms of its function as opposed to where it was actually sitting. So perhaps that's a good way to explain that particular verse. So you get into the most holy place and you have the Ark of the Covenant, perhaps the most important and vital piece of the entire tabernacle. The ark was the footstool of God. David said that he wanted to build a home, and he called the ark the footstool of God. God really wasn't there. It was his footstool, which is interesting because most of the kings of those days, pagan kings, they would have a footstool that was about the same size as this. And of course, when you went into their places, you'd have idols of the gods, but not in this particular location. There was no idol of God himself. This was God's footstool, and in a sense, symbolically, His presence would meet with the high priest on this one particular day of the year. The ark symbolized God's presence, but again, it was in the most holy place, which was inaccessible to all but one person. Only the high priest could go into this one room one time a year. And even his access to that place was limited to just that one time on the Day of Atonement. Then you have the mercy seat on top of the ark. God says, "There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony." So between these two cherubs, God's presence was manifested in the cloud of incense on the Day of Atonement. We read about that in Leviticus 16 and verse 2. A little bit more symbolism. So the most holy place was a cube, and here you have the actual measurements of it. If you look at Revelation 21:16, quiet, Larry, on this one. "The city's laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width." And he measured the city with the rod, 1,500 miles, its length, width, and height are the same. So, if the most holy place is symbolic of heaven, what do you think the holy place is symbolic of? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Perhaps it's the earth, and the veil is the actual firmament. And Jesus passed through that veil to get to God's place in heaven. Yes, sir, Michael. Ah, I didn't think about that one. Garden of Eden was also square, Michael says. Where do you find that, Michael? Obviously in the book of Genesis? Yeah? I'm not sure I've actually read that. All right. So then we get to the contents of the ark. Three different things in the ark itself. You have the pot of manna. What do you think the pot of manna perhaps represented? About God's care for them. Yeah, His care for them. All right. So God was actually faithful to His people. He gave them food. Well, they were wondering. I wonder, though, if perhaps the pot that was made out of clay and the food that was in there, which was earthly food, although it was sent from God and it lasted a long time, it was still food. I wonder if that was perhaps a subtle hint that, this was really temporary. It was meant to be done away with. And we'll see in verse 9, chapter 9 and verse 10, that it really dealt with things like food and pertaining to the old law. Okay, so you have the pot of manna, you also have the rod of Aaron, Aaron's rod that budded. It affirmed God's choice of Aaron as priest. Its inclusion in the ark alongside the tablets of the law reinforced the idea that the covenant and the priesthood went together. All right, which shows, once again, if one is phased out, the other one goes with it. If the law is replaced, the priesthood is as well. All right, it was temporary. And then you have the tablets of the covenant. The Decalogue, which itself was a summary of the entire law. If God has said that there's going to be a new one, what does that imply about the first one? It's going away, yes. And that's what we read in chapter 8 when he quoted Jeremiah 31. The law has also changed. Since Jesus is now the high priest, there's a change of the law. Okay, so let me ask you this. Why didn't the writer, as he's writing these folks, they could probably look out and they would walk by what we read about in Matthew 24. They would see Herod's temple. Beautiful, big place, wonderful place. How come he didn't talk about that as opposed to this tent that was in the wilderness? Any thoughts on perhaps why he would bring that up as opposed to what he did going back to the actual tabernacle? I think about this in terms of chapter 3 when I ask, why would the writer not bring up negatives about Moses? As he was going to compare Jesus and Moses, he didn't bring up the fact that Moses sinned. Moses wasn't able to go into the land. He brought up the fact that one example in his life that was perhaps one of the highest points in Moses' life. And he says, okay, look at Jesus in comparison to Moses at his absolute highest point. Similar to this, why would he bring up the actual tabernacle versus Solomon's temple or either Herod's temple? Any thought? Yeah, James?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, God had given Moses the imagery for the tabernacle. So he was doing everything that God... What Moses built, he built it exactly.
Yeah.
The way God had wanted. So maybe that's...
I think that's actually my first point here, James. He speaks of it most... He speaks of the tabernacle that's most linked with the Mosaic system in its pristine form. It was as God said. This is how you're going to build it. Put these items into it. And so he goes back to its pristine form and says, let's compare that law with this law. Let's look at it. Let's look at where Jesus is and where he does his work in comparison to what God gave Moses in his pristine form, as well as what was true of this particular temple. Now we know, I can find a verse for Solomon's temple. Couldn't find a verse for the point I'm going to make next, but it is written in history by Josephus, and that is, the actual temple did not have the ark. Well, we'd already said that perhaps the item that was most vital is the actual presence of God, which was symbolized by the ark. It's gone. It's not even there. All right? And if you go back to Solomon's temple, the actual contents of the ark, two of them were gone. It says the only thing that was in there, it wasn't the pot of manna, it wasn't Aaron's rod, they were gone. It was just the law that was given to them. It's not in its pristine form. Okay? And so perhaps that... Let's run through this real quickly. The Ark of the Covenant, the last we hear of the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible is in Josiah's reform, sometime in the 620 BCs. So we don't know exactly what happened to it. It's possible that it was taken away by the Babylonians. We can read about that in 2 Chronicles 36:18, where they came through and they took the contents of God's house. All right, so perhaps it was taken then. Josephus says that in this most holy place of the temple in the time of Jesus, there was nothing in it. Things were gone. If you look at the actual Mishnah, it says what they did on the Day of Atonement, they would go in and where the ark was, they had a stone. And they would place the incense or the coals of fire on top of the stone. There's no ark. All right? So perhaps that explains... One other thing before I get there. Jeremiah 3:16. This is interesting here to me. Jeremiah says, talking about these days and the days of Christ, he says, it shall be in those days when Christ comes, when you are multiplied and increased in the land, declares the Lord, that they will no longer say, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and it will not come to mind, nor will they remember it, nor will they miss it, nor will it be made again. For those who are now part of this new law, with a greater priest and the greater sanctuary, greater promises, you don't think to yourself, you shouldn't think to yourself, oh, the ark, where's the ark? We don't need the ark. That was part of the old law. It's been done away with. We have Christ. You see, their mind was messed up. They were drifting from the truth, from the faith. They were drifting, and they were looking back to these things when they shouldn't have. They should have focused on Jesus. Hebrews 12 says, in this race that we're on, focus on Christ. And they began to drift from that. And they were now saying, well, let's go back to the ark. The ark is gone. All you had to do was just look and see. There is no ark. Don't go back to it. And perhaps that's why he says, but of these things we cannot now speak in detail. He doesn't have time. He needs to move on. But perhaps this is a subtle way of saying, I can't talk about it because why? It's not there. It's gone. The old law is gone. God, His intention was to move away from the old law. It wasn't what God meant for the long term, and we'll see why as we move into these next few verses. Now, when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. So we see that the priests were going into the holy place every single day, and they were doing things like working with the seven branch lamp stand. They'd have to put the oil in there. They'd have to light them each day. They'd have to burn the incense on the altar. And then they would have to, once a week on the Sabbath, the loaves of showbread were replaced and the priest ate the old loaves. So they were doing all these things day after day, and all these duties were given to the ordinary priest, but in these duties they were not in the presence of God, for God did not dwell in the holy place. All right? But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. All right, inside the Holy of Holies was the ark, before which the high priest alone stood in God's presence on this one day. Okay? Otherwise, the Holy of Holies was strictly off limits to everyone. And I'll say this a few times. These restrictions emphasized the inaccessibility of God in the old law. You could not get to God. That's how God meant it to be. Okay? And the old law and this actual structure pointed out, you cannot get to God. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, or he will die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. He shall put on the holy linen tunic, and the linen undergarment shall be next to his body, and he shall be girded with a linen sash and attired with a linen turban. Then he shall bathe his body in water and put them on. Then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. He shall take two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. And then Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell and make it a sin offering. He shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire from upon the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense and bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony. Otherwise, he will die." The high priest would first slaughter the bull and sprinkle its blood on and in front of the mercy seat to atone for his own sins. Then he would go back outside. He would slaughter the goat. And then he would go back into the most holy place and sprinkle that blood on and in front of the mercy seat for the people's sins. I like this picture because if you look at the face of this particular high priest, does it look joyous? Does it look relaxed? Does it look bold? Did he come to this particular throne with boldness and confidence? What is the message that the law of Moses is trying to make about the high priest's presence in the most holy place, God's symbolic presence? Do you really belong there? You really don't. And when you do go, you better make sure that you do everything right or you will die. It's not like when you got done doing this, you grabbed a chair and you sat down for a while just to kind of hang out. Not that there was a chair there, but you got in and you got out and you made sure that you were doing everything right. This was really not a place that God meant for folks to be. It was a symbol. God is sending a message. All right? Yes, sir.
There's even some evidence that they put a rope around the ankle of the high priest so that if he did die in there, they could pull him out.
Yeah. So if you did die, I wouldn't want to go in there either. You'd pull the rope and... Yeah. Okay. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol, something that was intended to point beyond itself and provide a conceptual explanation for something else. This tabernacle was an earthly way of showing the spiritual reality that has come in the present time, which I think is referring to the last days or the messianic age. It is a symbol for the present time. It should have meaning to us. The place where God dwelt was kept inaccessible by the veil that separated the most holy place from everything and everyone else. After completing all the sacrifices, just as God said to do it, the average Jew, could they get to God? Could they get into the holy place? the average Jew? After you do everything that God said? No, you cannot. Can you get into the most holy place? Absolutely not. Access denied. You cannot get in. Even when you've done all that God had said. And year after year, sacrifices are made. They could not make the worshiper clear, clean, in conscience. Okay? To be in the symbolic presence of God. The Mosaic system symbolized the concept of God, a man's inability to be in fellowship with Him because of sin, in spatial terms. All right, so it's laid out for you. Here's the courtyard and the altar and the holy place and the most holy. You can't get to God, and it's shown to us in a symbol, in spatial terms. You cannot get to God. In contrast, what we'll see in this particular chapter 9, the one sacrifice of Jesus, our new high priest, accomplished something that the Mosaic system never could. He entered into the real presence of God in heaven with His own blood, and as a result of that, our conscience can be cleansed. We're going to talk about that right now. I struggled with this. So it says here, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings and regulations for the body. All right, so what does this mean when it says that it cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience? So the Greek, the word for perfect means it denotes bringing in something to completion so that it does not lack any parts. These offerings which were prescribed under the old law did not perfect the ones who brought them. We see that in 7:19 and in 9:9 we'll see it in chapter 10 as well. The author frames this in terms of a contrast between rituals that were aimed at the flesh, cleansed the flesh, but they really didn't fix that deeper problem, the aspect of sin that's in the soul, in the conscience. The failure of the forgiveness offered up under the old system was that it could not cleanse the conscience. Now, one question I had was, so in the old law, did God forgive sins? And I think the answer to that is absolutely yes, He did. If you look at all of these verses, it says, God says, if you offer these sacrifices, your sins will be forgiven. I believe that God did do that. He wiped away their sins in the old law. All right? But the worshiper, perhaps, was still left with a sense of inadequacy because what was offered for sin did not match the guilt of that sin. How could the blood of an animal forgive the sins of a rational human being? Technically, it can't, right? Because that's what Hebrews 10:1 says. The blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. And really, when you got done with all that, once again, access to God was not available. Even when you did all the things that God said, you still didn't have access to God. Something just wasn't right. It just doesn't make any sense. Over and over, when I sin, I have to bring this animal who didn't do anything, who isn't saying, yes, I willfully am going to die for you. No, you just grab this goat or bull or ram, whatever it is, and you kill them over and over again. And every single year, this occurs. Prophet Micah wrestled with this very imperfection, as he said, with what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to Him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams, in 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts? The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? You see, we're talking about the sin of your soul, not some kind of I'm unclean because I touched a body that was dead. No, this is something that's inside of us that affects our mind. And we need the right type of sacrifice to cleanse us from that, to take away that guilt. Illustration. So let's say that James owes me $10 million. If he doesn't pay it, big fines, big problems. One day, I come to James and I say, James, you know, I'm going to let you pay this debt off, and I'm going to let you do it in play money. Bring me $10 million of play money. But I need you to do that every year, James, on the same day. All right? Though James paid that with play money, how do you feel about that, James? You feel good about that? Yeah. He still owes me. Because it's not real. But finally, say my dad comes along. I wish he had $10 million. And he says, okay, James, I will pay you off. I'm going to settle this debt for you. It's all been paid. Now, how do you feel, James? Would that change you about how you feel about Billy? Would you ever turn your back on him? And I think perhaps that explains us Jeremiah 31, the old law and the new law. Okay? And so the old law worked from the outside in. So you were born a Jew, you followed rules, you were a Jew, right? And you relied on the people to teach you about God. In this new law, those who come into this new covenant, do they know about God? The only way you're going to get into it is because you know about God. And because you say Jesus is the Christ, and you come into this new agreement with Christ. And so it works from the inside out. I'm changed in heart. And when I see what Christ has done, when God Himself came down to this earth and became a man and died in the way He did, that should change me. And you understand that He said, I'm willing to die for those who have sinned. Those who I made who have sinned, I'm willing to die and shed my own blood. That should change us from the inside out. In this new law, people don't have to teach us about who Jesus is. We know because that's the way we get into this new covenant is because we understand what Christ has done, and it changes us and it cleanses us. And the guilt is gone because of what Christ has done for us, His sacrifice. All right? One other thing I want to bring out is the idea of cleanliness was spelled out in terms of food and drink and washings with water and other such regulations that address the matter of cleansing in a fleshly way. But the rites and regulations centered around physical things could not touch the real problem, which was a guilty conscience. But by the grace of God, we'll see in verse 15, the sacrifice of Christ is effective today, it was effective back then, and it reaches all the way back to cleanse the actual conscience and the sins of Abraham and David. That is, God isn't bound by time. And so it can reach back, it can reach forward, what Christ has done for us. But by God's grace, He was able to wipe away the sins from those in the past. However, in the New Covenant, perfect forgiveness is available according to the promise He made through Jeremiah on the basis of the perfect death of Jesus on our behalf. And so that leads us to the heart of Hebrews. I think chapters 4, at the end of that, 4:14 through now, kind of leads to this one point. Okay, the contrast between the old and the new can be laid out in full. And I think we see it right here in the heart of Hebrews, purification from dead works. And it says, but when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, He entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of bulls and goats and calves, but through His own blood. He entered the holy place once and for all. ESV says holy places. Other versions say the most holy place. Okay, having obtained eternal redemption for us. That is what Christ did for us. His sacrifice was once for all by His own blood, not the blood of bulls and goats. Did it once, and He obtained eternal redemption for us. But then it says the priest, they worked all the time. They would go back year after year. They would offer sacrifices. But Jesus' sacrifice was one time. It's all that needed to be done, one time. The other ones, year after year, showing that it was inadequate to do what God wanted it to do. Okay? This did not have to be repeated. Now, this is kind of strange. If the blood of bulls and goats, which we understand what that is, and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh. Well, that's interesting. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to throw up the slides on this. So, one of the worst things that you could do in the old law, you could become defiled and unclean because you touched a body that was dead. So let's say you had a loved one who died. They were in the bed. You had to go get that loved one. Well, you had to touch a dead body. You had to touch the sheets. There was this uncleanness all around. And as a result of you dealing with this one who's dead, you therefore become unclean. You didn't sin. You're unclean. You're defiled. And this says that if you touch a dead body, which is the opposite of the living God, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean for 7 days. And the way that they would clean, they would cleanse a person who was defiled by this, is explained in Numbers 19:11. And it includes the idea of a heifer. So you would slaughter and burn the heifer, and the priest would sprinkle the blood in front of the tabernacle. He would store the ashes outside of the camp. Then he would make holy water, right? Sprinkle the ashes and the water and the hyssop on the unclean, and that would make them clean. Okay? But when you sin, what was killed? Animals were killed. The same thing. Okay? And the point is, the problem is that when we sin, it isn't some make-believe unseen thing that's on us. I'm defiled because I actually touched this body. I can't see it, but God says that then I'm defiled. That's not what we're actually talking about. We're talking about sin and what it does to us, to our souls, to our minds, to our conscience. This is different. In contrast to the purifying that was done in the old law, what was Christ's offering able to accomplish? And it says here, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? What Jesus has done can cleanse us and cause us to leave behind dead works, which are sin, right? Leave those behind. Have them wiped away. Now we can turn cleansed in our minds and we can serve this living God. In the old law, you couldn't do that. In the new law, there's a way for us to have our conscience cleansed. All right? I want to get through 15 through 22 if possible. So, it says, for this reason, He is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that... Let's get here. All right. Okay, so this point right here about the transgressions that were up under the first law, first covenant, we've already said that the blood of Christ reaches back and cleanses them. All right, so we won't spend any time on that. Those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance, for where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. Now, this is weird to us, because when we think about a last will or a testament, when does that go into force? When you die. Covenant, though? What? You can make that without death, right? But this points us back to an event that occurred in Exodus chapter 24, which what happened back then? Exodus 24. Moses received the law, sprinkled the blood on them. So they said, okay, I'll be your God, you'll be my people if you follow my laws. And so they ratified the law, they took the animal and they killed it, and they sprinkled the blood on the people and on the altar in the book itself. And they actually ratified it. And I was going to explain a little bit more about this idea of covenant. But there's a Greek word that goes both ways. It can be used, this Greek word, diatheke, can be used as a last will or testament. It can also be used as a covenant. All right. So he's using this word to play between both of these thoughts here. Right. And so he goes on to say, therefore, the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. And this is when we get to what happened in Exodus 24. It says this is the blood of the covenant. Moses said, this is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you. Which reminds us of that second covenant. And when Jesus said what in Matthew 26? This is my blood of what? Of the covenant. Okay? And so that's in Matthew 26:28. This covenant was ordained on the basis of the blood that was shed for it, and Jesus' blood was shed to bring about the second covenant, His covenant, that was, and His blood was poured out for the forgiveness of sins. All right. And he goes on to say, and according to the law, one may almost say that all things are cleansed with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Blood had to be shed by Christ for forgiveness to be wiped away. Let me get to this last section. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in heavens to be cleansed with these, but heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. All right, so God has always wanted us to be with Him, and He has given Christ to allow us to be in His presence. Nor was it that He would offer Himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, He would have need to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the consummation of the ages, He has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of Himself. All right? Inasmuch, I'm just going to skip through as this. What's left at this point? All right? He has come in these last days to put away sin by the sacrifice of Himself. That's what Jesus has done for us. It's already done. One-time sacrifice. Well, what's left to happen? That's what we see in these next two verses. Inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after that comes judgment. Okay, so what? This is strange. Why would you even bring this up? I think there are two things going on here. It shows that the hypothetical idea here that Jesus would suffer and die many times that we saw back in verse 26 doesn't happen. Okay, it's also going to say that even though the death of Christ was important, there's more to the story. All right? So just as we die once, how many times did Christ die? One time. All right. And so it says now that He's been offered once to bear the sins of many. He will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin. Is Jesus going to return to deal with the sin problem again? Is He going to die for us for sin again? No. His reason He's going to return has nothing to do with sin because He's already dealt with those. But He's going to come back to pick those up who eagerly wait for Him. It's those who are longing and waiting for the Christ. He'll come back to get us, but it has nothing to do with the sin issue. He's already dealt with that. Sorry I had to rush through that, the last bit of it, and join us for Wednesday, and we'll cover chapter 10. Thank you.